Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Food. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva. Have you ever wanted to write a cookbook, thought about starting a food blog, or yearned to be an Instagram influencer, or join the waning ranks of restaurant reviewers? Well, the first step towards any of these aspirations is to get a hold of Will Write for Food, pursue your passion, and bring home the dough writing recipes, cookbooks, blogs, and more by Diane Jacob. This was certainly the advice I received when I was getting started in food writing, and I'm deeply grateful for it. I returned to Will Write for Food again and again for insight, reassurance, best practices, and information that simply isn't found anywhere else. I credit the book with helping me to hone and refine my approach to food writing and find my writer's voice. It's no exaggeration to call Diane Jacob America's foremost food writing guru. Her book, blog, and informative website are invaluable resources for the aspiring food writer. She's a coach and a cheerleader, presenting a smorgasbord of options on how to break into food writing, but also offers valuable and necessary cautionary advice that can help you put on the brakes before leaping into an unnecessary abyss. Will Write for Food will be released this month in its fourth edition, updated to reflect the many changes that have taken place in the world of food writing since it first came out in 2005. And I'm delighted that it welcomes Diane Jacob to the New Books in Food channel. Diane, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, the book is in its fourth edition, Will Write for Food, and it's an update of the original book that you first published in 2005. Can we take you back to the initial motivation for writing this guide, which, as I said in my introduction, is really essential reading for those who are interested in the craft of food writing? How did the book come about, and how have you kept it so on point and so very relevant for the last 16 years?
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. Well, in 2004, I started teaching food writing. I had been a journalist, a newspaper editor, magazine editor, book publishing editor, and I wrote restaurant reviews on the side, and then I started writing feature articles and recipes. And so I thought, well, I'd love to teach about this subject because I don't see anywhere that anyone's teaching food writing. So I started, and then I looked for a book on the subject, and there was no book. So I thought, well, maybe I should write one. And so it had the very dull title of How to Write About Food I submitted the manuscript, which the publisher and I went around and around on titles. And finally, my agent said, why don't you ask like 20 of your closest writer friends to come up with a better title for you over the weekend? And one of them did. And that's how we got Will Write for Food.
It's perfect. It's a perfect title.
And as for how it stayed relevant over the years, well, you know, things change. Things go in and out of fashion. For example, fine dining was a huge, huge market for food writers when the first edition came out. And it was all about going to, you know, expensive restaurants that people were going to take their mothers to on their birthday and telling readers, you know, is this worth your money? Because it was going to be an investment for them. And what were they going to get? And how could they look ahead and imagine themselves there in a review? But now in the fourth edition, hardly anyone is a restaurant reviewer anymore. It's really only the top jobs at a few daily papers, and Yelp has supplanted your need to find out about restaurants. It's very easy to use, and there are lots of opinions. Some of them are suspect, but the role of the one high and mighty, usually white man with an expense account who goes to very expensive restaurants is totally outdated.
That's perhaps that's a good thing.
I think so.
I think so too.
I mean, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, our restaurant reviewer is Soleil Ho, who is a young Vietnamese American woman who was a chef And she has a completely different take on what kind of restaurant she wants to talk about and what kind of issues she wants to bring up.
Mm-hmm. And as you started out as a journalist, how has that informed your approach to food writing in general, but also into advising others how to get started in it?
Well, I think it was just the best background I could have possibly had, because the skill that I learned in journalism school, which was basically how to become a newspaper reporter and editor, served me my entire career because everything about it was made for anyone who wants to write nonfiction. You have to understand what's news, what's a good headline, how to write a great introduction to your article, how to fact check, how to research information, how to quote people, how to do historical research. I mean, just about any topic in food writing can be aided by journalism skills. And so I realized that people come into food writing from all different ways. They might have been a writer in another field. They might have been a chef. They might have been a caterer. Maybe they're just an enthusiastic home cook, and they don't necessarily have all these skills. So it's some of the things that I bring up in We'll Write for Food and in my coaching.
And it's interesting because, as you say, a lot of people do get very excited about the idea of writing about food, which is rooted in fact. I mean, a recipe is a very exact sort of thing. If you mess it up, you mess up the recipe, but you also need those sort of descriptive and highly evocative kind of writing. So you juggle lots of different skill sets, I think, in the food writing world.
Oh, definitely. Like, I don't think sensuousness in writing was a part of my journalism training. You know, if you're covering a court case or a fire, it doesn't necessarily come up, but, in food writing, it's an essential part of the job is to, go with the five senses and get people to be able to taste it and smell it and feel it.
And how do you think people can develop that skill set?
Well, I think it's a necessary skill, but I also think that it's overrated because people get really wrapped up in using a lot of adjectives. I mean, first of all, if they're just saying this is delicious and yummy and tasty, that's really not helpful to anyone. But even stringing a lot of adjectives together is also not good writing. Like if you talk about the decadent fudgy brownie, I don't know that you're really telling anybody something that they don't already know. I don't know that it's helpful. If you said cakey, I think it would be helpful because there are different kinds of brownies. I mean, even fudgy, I guess, is okay because you can imagine a cakey brownie, you can imagine a fudgy brownie, and you know they're not the same thing. But you do have to choose carefully and limit yourself.
But your own voice is something I think about a lot, because whenever I read Will Write for Food, I feel like my blood pressure comes down because there's so much encouragement there. But often it kind of spikes up because you make a real point of underscoring how competitive an industry this is. And I wondered how that balance of voice had developed, because it is so uniquely you. And I always emerge thinking, yes, I can do this. But it's just super competitive. Tell me how that voice developed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I try to be very practical and encouraging, but I'm also a realist about the situation. And, you know, if you're going to be one of a million people writing about meatloaf, what are you going to do that's different? That's really the question. And the best way to deal with that is, I mean, unless you have like your Sichuan version of meatloaf and your Korean version of meatloaf, really the only other way to differentiate yourself is by having a strong voice and a voice that's recognizable to people as yours.
That's fair.
I don't think people really get how important it is if everyone's writing about the same thing.
Right. And do you find that there's a tendency, I think, that many people have gone very specific, like this is the meatloaf blogger. So it's not going to just write about one meatloaf, but about every imaginable meatloaf there is.
Well, there you go. Maybe that's a new cookbook. Possible.
So food blog, we've talked about food blogging, but there are lots of ways, your book makes it very clear that there are lots of different ways that you can be a food writer, from restaurant reviewing, which you say is on the wane, to Instagram influencing, which some people would argue is not writing. And in the book, you go through these all in a lot of detail. And I noticed that the table of contents hasn't really changed since earlier editions, but things have changed a great deal
a
in
little
the
bit.
Guide. Yeah. I think I have the second edition of Will Write for Food.
Yeah. It's mostly the same. In the first edition, I had a chapter on writing fiction because there is a whole genre of food writing fiction. They are murder mysteries called cozies, and they have the most fantastic names, like The Butter Did It. And they're just hilarious. And they have recipes in them. The heroine of one series is a caterer. So they're very food focused. But after a while, I realized that my readers were all about nonfiction and weren't really into that. So I got rid of that chapter.
And what are some of the other changes that you've seen from in the ways that people are expressing themselves writing about food since you first wrote the book?
Well, you said that Instagram is not really food blogging, but I just talked to someone recently who has a very large following, and she uses Instagram like a blog. She writes. A head note, and then she writes her recipe right in the blog, right in the Instagram post. And that's how she goes about it. And when you think of it that way, it's really not that different from a recipe-based blog, because there's a photo of the dish, and there's the recipe, and there's some preamble. And I guess she cuts down on the preamble. So it can be used. Instagram can be used as a blog very successfully, I think. But other than that, I think what the most important change is who's writing about food. And it used to be the providence of, you know, food writing was very Eurocentric. It was all based on our fascination with French and Italian food, and fine dining was almost always a French restaurant, sometimes an Italian restaurant, and the writers were pretty much white until maybe the last 5 years, where all kinds of different people are, you know, have broken into the field and are writing about what's important to them, and we're learning about different kinds of food than just, you know, American comfort food and Italian and French food. I mean, people are still obsessed with those foods, and that's great. But now we have a wider range. Like, there's a Nigerian cookbook coming out from 10 Speed soon, and a lot of foods that we really didn't know much about, as, you know, more people are uplifted and come to the table.
And at the same time, there's the rise of this concern about cultural appropriation, which you tackle in the newest edition of the book. We've never been more global about our approach to finding, enjoying, appreciating good food. But we, as food writers, we have to be really careful how we explore this wonderful world of different cultures without causing offense. And how do you tackle this issue?
Well, I think it's about respect. That I think where people get upset is if you travel to a country and ask people for their recipes, and then you publish a cookbook, so you make money off their food, but they are not recognized in any way. They're not part of the book. They're not, I mean, every once in a while you might mention someone, but but basically it's all food from outside your own experience that you are appropriating for profit. Mm-hmm. So that does upset people, and rightly so. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can only write about the food that you grew up with and that you can't talk about anything else, but you have to do it in a way that's inclusive, where you recognize who else was involved and give credit. And, you know, I had someone write about this on my blog, and it struck home for me because I wrote a recipe for a dish that my mother makes. And I mean, I just experienced it as a kid and loved it and wrote it up. I haven't published it yet or anything, but I just used that framework to think about the dish that it came from my childhood. But actually, I never thought about, well, where did my mother find out about this dish and who else makes it and who are they? And it's, you know, my mother was born and raised in China, and it's a Chinese dish, and my mother's not Chinese. And so it never occurred to me that I should try and figure out, well, is this a dish from her town of Shanghai? And are there any other recipes online or in books that where people could explain it? Maybe it has a history. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So it was a good lesson for me too, to think more broadly. I wouldn't want a Chinese person to read my recipe and say, hey, you know, I ate this my whole life and I don't know what she's talking about here.
Right. Well, and I think in some ways, a lot of the really good food blogs do that kind of forensic work into one kind of cuisine or another. That I'm thinking of one about a wonderful cake maker called the Grand Baby Cake or something like that, and really takes her grandmother's cake recipes and kind of tries to find out, you know, where did they come from? What was it? You know, what was the occasion that she would use the cake for? And I think these are wonderful ways of exploring the world. But I you're right. We have to be super careful about not stepping on any toes, because as we know, food writing careers have been destroyed.
They have. People
yes.
have been fired for offending other people.
Right. And quite recently. So it's a good idea to be sensitive, I think. Food seems so universal, and yet people are very, they kind of guard their food. I know this because I write about a cuisine that isn't my own. I write about Russian food. And I often get, you know, feedback and comments like, you know, well, what does this American girl know? From some Russian who lives in New Jersey, who left when he or she was 7. I'm like, guy, I've been living in Russia for 20 years.
right.
So, but I understand, you know, I try to be super sensitive about that as well.
Yes. It's a sensitive topic. A lot of people don't understand why they need to make any effort and think they can write about whatever they want. And it's an education process. But people do get in an uproar all the time. In my last newsletter, I wrote about how Epicurious stated recently that they were going to stop putting beef recipes on their blog. And I said it was a great idea. Uh-huh. And I got so many annoyed responses to that. You just wouldn't believe it.
People have really taken against this or for it, with such passion. I was quite surprised. I think it's an interesting idea. And it certainly will set them apart from, you know, all the other large platforms.
Well, as David Leibovitz pointed out in his newsletter, there's, you know, Bon Appetit has more than 1,000 recipes, or Epicurious has more than 1,000 recipes that use beef on its website. So it's not like you can't find it there anymore.
Mm-hmm. Just going forward, they're
not that big a deal.
Yeah.
But it was a kind of a political statement, and they got a lot of blowback for that.
Uh-huh.
Because food can be very political.
Absolutely.
And that's what you were just talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about food blogging, because I think a lot of your readers who pick up your book are musing over whether to start a food blog or have reboot one that, you know, has gone moribund. These can be anything from just personal musings to very complicated six-figure businesses. And that's kind of exploded in the last decade or so. Can you take us through that arc of how food blogging just went, became such a big deal?
Okay, sure. Mm-hmm. So when my 2010 edition came out, in 2005, food blogging had just started, and I was still a snobby print person thinking, well, where are the gatekeepers? You know, I have to pitch stories and be edited, and there are all these gatekeepers in print, so where are the gatekeepers in food blogging, where anyone can just put whatever they want online? So I didn't take it very seriously, and I left it out of the 2005 edition. And then in the 2010 edition, whoa, it had just gone crazy. So many people had started blogs, and they were really hot, and people were becoming famous from starting blogs, and they were starting to get book deals. And then I had to donate like 7,000 words to designate 7,000 words or so to writing about this new phenomenon, which by then wasn't even that new. But at first, it was really a form. A blog is like a diary for a lot of people, or at least it was when it first started. And you could just talk about what you made or what you ate or where you went. And it was a form of self-expression, and it was fun. And over the years, the first thing that happened was it was just text. And then the internet got much more photo-centric, and then you had to put photos on your blog, and then you had to take good photos because you couldn't put horrible glossy pictures of brown things into your blog post.
I can feel my blood pressure going up, Diane. I can feel my blood pressure.
Oh, sorry, sorry, sorry.
No, it's true. It's true.
You know, the standards are going up for what was an acceptable photo or what was even a good photo. And then it became much more technical, where people became obsessed with search engine optimization, so that, you know, if someone wanted to find a recipe for Sichuan green beans, that if they put that into the search, that your recipe would come up first from your blog. And so now it's a big competition to see who can get the highest search returns on Google, and how do you do that? And it's just become more and more technical and more business-like as the years go on, to the point where, some people have staffs, they have people who write the posts, people who take the photos, people who upload the work, people who put everything on social media, the person who handles their Pinterest account, sometimes even the person who develops the recipe. There are some Facebook groups where you can buy photos of food that might look like something you want to develop a recipe for, and then you just, you know, pay $100 for a photo, and then you don't have to worry about whether you're a great photographer. And mm-hmm. if it's a chocolate donut, then you just develop a recipe for a chocolate donut.
So these are complex business. I mean, this is like any other business. It's got lots of different employees handling various aspects of what's really a very multifaceted
absolutely
thing. It's very complex. Yep. So
yes,
so,
and can be very lucrative also.
Right. I was just about to ask you, like, what does one need to be a successful food blogger, apart from, you know, minions and lots of good photos?
Well, I think a lot of these people put in a 60 to 80 hour work week, mm-hmm. and they juggle, you know, personal assistants who might live in another country, and all kinds of contractors whom they've hired to produce their blog posts. And it's really an entrepreneurial business at that point. where they're the head of it.
Right. Let's turn to something that is equally time-consuming and labor-intensive, which is cookbook writing. You teach a lot of courses on this, and full disclosure, I've taken two of them, and I highly recommend them to anyone thinking about writing a cookbook, because you really break it down and make into its component parts and take away all the sort of mystique about how you get a cookbook out to a publisher. But it seems to me that in lockdown, everybody has gone back into their kitchens, whether they were into it or not. And they've rediscovered cookbooks. And are you seeing like a huge uptick in cookbook publishing as a result of the pandemic? You think is this a good time to publish a cookbook?
I think so. Well, first mm-hmm. of all, if you wanted to publish a cookbook today, it probably wouldn't come out for at least 2 years, because that's mm-hmm. how long it takes to write a proposal and find an agent or find a publisher, get a contract, write the thing, get the thing photographed, and have it printed. So it is a very long process to be traditionally published. If you self-publish, it can be shorter, but you can't. I mean, it still has the same kinds of steps. Mm-hmm. You just don't have to sell it to somebody because you're doing it yourself. And then that means you're paying all the bills yourself, too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a great time. I mean, any time is a great time for a cookbook. They're always going to sell. Publishers always want them. And especially during the pandemic, since people were cooking more than ever, it was... Mm-hmm. I think it was, I read an article that said it was hard for the new books because the only way to promote them was online and everybody had to figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. But that books that had already been out and were well known had a big boost in sales.
I think bread books did well.
Bread books went crazy. Baking books went yeah. crazy. In fact, a woman I met decided that she wanted to do a cookbook, and she pulled people in the offices where she worked, and there were offices all over the world. So she had, you know, the South Asians supply these recipes, and the South Americans do that those recipes, and then when it came to Americans, the only recipes they submitted were baking recipes, because that's what we were all doing. We were all stuffing ourselves with banana bread and sourdough bread.
Well, listeners, you heard it here first. What you need to do is actually to write an exercise book, because I think we're all coming out of the pandemic with a slightly larger waistline.
I read that the average weight gain is 29 pounds.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm feeling now, yeah, now my blood pressure is coming way down because I definitely didn't have this.
You can feel good about yourself.
I feel much better. My husband spent, he's not a food writer, and he spent the lockdown riding his Peloton bike every day for 6 months. His waistline looks great. But okay, so it's probably a good time to write a cookbook. What about the role of social media? I know that a lot of people who have big, big social media accounts turn to cookbook writing. Do you need to have tons and tons and tons of followers? And how do you define tons?
Well, yeah, this is a really heartbreaking subject for a lot of people. This is the one where your blood pressure is going to go up. But mm-hmm. yeah, typically, publishers are looking for someone who already has a built-in following for their book. So if you're on social media day and night and you are obsessed with Chinese flatbreads and that's all you talk about day and night, and you build a huge following because other people love Chinese flatbreads and want to make green onion pancakes and everything else, then if you grow your following, then yes, you do start to look attractive to a publisher who thinks, oh, you know, she could write a book on this subject. But what the number is, I don't, as big as possible is the number that publishers like. A woman emailed me recently to say that she has an Instagram account and an agent called her and said she could get her a deal at Simon & Schuster to write a cookbook, and did she want it? And that just blew me away. I didn't know you could get a book deal like that, but apparently you can.
Good to know.
Yeah, but most of us are not in that category.
Right.
So it's more of a struggle to build any kind of a following.
And when we say we're using social medias, we're sort of lumping them all together. Is there one platform that is more suited than others, in your opinion?
Well, right now, Instagram is really hot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, before that, Pinterest. Yeah, those are the two platforms for bloggers, or Pinterest. Pinterest draws a tremendous amount of traffic food blogs. Instagram is a way to grow your following. Of course, both of them rely on great photography. So that's part of the problem. So you don't think, you think you can just write about food and that's it, but actually you have to understand marketing and promotion and social media and photography and search engine optimization and how to use hashtags and 10 billion other subjects that you think, oh, what does this have to do with anything? I just want to write my recipe for pupusas, you know, and it's not quite that simple.
Right. What about something that doesn't rely so heavily on social media, such as memoir, or the travel / cookbook, which I think is very popular now. You've seen a lot of these books that, like Red Sands, is a fusion of travel with food. How do you feel about that aspect?
I don't think you can escape building a social media following, no matter what kind of book you have. It's just part of the job. Sadly. I mean, there's a lot of people who really hate the idea and don't want to do it, but basically they need to figure out how to enjoy it.
Because it can be fun. I mean, I spent some time over the last weekend. My Pinterest account was just a mess, and I decided to spend some time cleaning it up and reorganizing. And all along the way, I found all these new writers that I hadn't heard of and got some new recipes for Asian noodles, and just it was a blast. It is super time consuming. And it's not, if you're going to take it seriously, it's not something you can do while you're watching Schitt's Creek or something.
And you can farm it out. I mean, I had a client who was a Chinese food blogger, and she farmed out her Pinterest page to some kind of virtual worker in another country. And I went to it, and all of a sudden there were recipes on there that were not Chinese. And so I asked her, what's going on with your Pinterest page? She said, however, her following was a couple hundred thousand. And so I said, what's going on in your Pinterest page? Just happened to go there the other day, and there are all these recipes that aren't even Chinese. And she said, that's my virtual assistant. I guess she got off topic, but look how big my following is, so I don't really care. So there you go.
Okay, so good to know. So you don't have to just obsess over meatloaf. You can expand out from meatloaf. You can also do brisket.
Exactly.
Okay. It's not all about social media. You still talk about in the book. You talk about the waning ranks of people who write for newspapers and magazines, and there we have the issue of the gatekeepers who are still in place. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about how to break in there. What you see is changing. And what your best advice might be.
Well, in the old days, you could get a job at a newspaper as a writer, or at a newspaper or magazine as a writer. There was a time, maybe in the 80s, I had a staff of 15 people when I was a magazine editor, and most of them were writers. But these days, all those people are freelance pretty much, and the editor is the employee who solicits and accepts freelance work. So they, as a result of that, they are just drowning in billions of emails, and it's harder than ever to get their attention if you want to pitch a story. So you have to really understand the publication and what they want and how they might, you know, position a story for their publication versus how a different magazine would position it. So, yeah, you have to break through all that to get your email read. It's hard.
Right. Or get noticed on Pinstagram.
Yes, you can. You can become Pinstagram. Oh no!
I know.
You can become known on social media to the point where an editor might contact you and say, "Hey, why don't you write an article for me?"
Mm-hmm.
That happens too.
Right. And if someone's just starting out and says, oh, you know, I don't have a big following and, you know, I'm not really confident about my writing, what are some of the first steps that you advise?
Well, they can start by starting a blog because in the beginning, no one reads it except your mother and your relatives and your best friend maybe. And it's a good way to play around. But your first step is not a book. And people often write to me and say, I'm ready to write a book. And it's the first thing they want to do. And they want me to help them get a publisher. And I publishers publish books that have writing in them. And so they want someone who is a published writer to write the book most of the time, unless you're famous. And then you have to hire someone who knows how to write the book for you or with you. Or rich. So it's really not a good place to start because you're going to be disappointed.
And what do you see on the horizon? I mean, when we talk about the fifth edition of Will Write for Food.
Oh my gosh.
Say in 5 years' time.
I'll be very elderly. I may be retired. But if
surely
not.
Surely not. Diane, you can't retire because nobody does what you do. So you have to stay working.
Oh my God. That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know what the next big thing is going to be. I just know that we all have to pay attention to it. Like, for example, I'm not on TikTok. I joined Clubhouse because someone told me I had to. It might have been David Leibovitz. He's very good at giving me advice about how I should be on top of things like he is. He seems to be on top of everything at all times.
Yeah, his Instagram cocktail hours got a lot of us through the lockdown.
Yes, exactly.
They're great, for sure.
But you know what? That was a pivot in book promotion when his book on cocktails came out. We were in a pandemic, and it was one of the first books to come out during that time. And nobody knew really what to do. So he just decided, I'm going to have a cocktail hour 6 days a week. And do it live. And I mean, that was a lot of work. And it's not like he was a TV personality. I mean, he's a cookbook author. And his partners co-starred in some of them. And now apparently his partner has his own fan club, Holman.
Oh, yeah.
And he was super successful at it. And he did it for a month, I think, 6 days a week live. And I'm sure it took over his whole life for a month. But it was a really ingenious way of, figuring out how to make the most of book promotion during the pandemic. You know, you had to go online and be live.
And I think there's a good lesson there that you have to be nimble and you have to be able to pick up the new technology, but you also have to stick to it. I mean, there's a dogged quality to I think the most successful food writers who just have to churn it out every, you know, 3 days or so.
Yes. And
yeah, I have a weekly column and I don't always want to write it, but
exactly.
I adore looking back at the archive because it's just voluminous at this point.
That's terrific.
Yeah, no, and it's something to be very proud of. But you know, you don't always want to roll up your sleeves and get out the flour and, you know, get to work.
Right. But that's what's good about a blog, especially if you say, I'm going to write something every Tuesday, then, you know, you are exercising your writing ability and you're improving. And for David, after a whole month of doing Instagram, where he had to be live and pretty much unrehearsed, he was a lot better at doing live events. And so he can, now he started doing them again, you know, 6 months or a year later, and he's really good at it. So,
yeah.
So that was a big learning curve that he jumped into. And that's something I would like to be better at is just saying, okay, time to learn this. I'm going to jump in. Because I'm usually like, well, I don't have time for that. I don't know if this is going to be anything or not. I've got all these excuses. And it takes me a long time to learn something new.
Well, there's so much to learn. I mean, I can't even face the notion of TikTok. I really can't. I just, that's one too many. Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to do on TikTok? I can't figure out what I would do.
I'm not sure. But that feta and cherry tomato thing went, I mean, globally viral.
Oh, that was pasta, right?
You roast the cherry. I mean, I've been roasting cherry tomatoes for pasta for like a millennium already.
Yes,
now.
Exactly.
Some, you know, TikToker puts some feta cheese in it and boom, you know, it's a movement.
It was a huge fab.
Anyway, but tell me what's next for you. You've written a number of books on pizza, which are excellent. Or you've co-authored them.
I co-authored them. The chef's recipes were excellent, not mine.
But is there another pizza book in the offing?
No. I think I made 275 pizzas, and my husband was very happy. Most of the time, I think we did get to pizza overload, if that's possible. But I didn't eat pizza like for 2 years after that. That was enough for me. No, not a cookbook. I've been trying to work on more personal stuff. It's really hard. It's different. It's a different kind of writing, and I still don't think I know how to do it very well. So I'm still working on it. It's a long project.
Do you find, a lot of writers I've spoken to during the pandemic have said that it's been very hard to settle down to, you know, a big passion project that, you know, you can churn out the stuff that is on deadline, but, you know, a book or a, you know, a big personal essay is just really, really hard. Have you found that to be the case?
Well, it's always hard to try to figure out how to shoehorn a new project into your work life, because you're busy and you don't have time. Or maybe you think you have time, but but then you have all this anxiety about starting this new project and you procrastinate, and it can be overwhelming. I like the advice that someone gave me a long time ago where he said, just do it for 15 minutes a day. And that was a way of breaking it down for me and not feeling like it was going to take over my life. And then once I started doing it for 50 minutes a day, I thought, wow, this is really fun. And then I was able to devote more time to it and really enjoy it and get into it.
I think that's right. I for one, location means a lot to me. So I would love to like go to the library, three times a week and just work on something, but that's not possible quite yet, but we'll hopefully get there.
Well, the first edition of A Write for Food, I think I got the book deal in the spring and it was due in November. And then my mother died in July.
I'm sorry.
And I was just a total basket case. And I remember my agent like made me go for a walk with her to get me out of the house and was trying to give me a pep talk because I hadn't written anything and it was August. And I ended up writing 80,000 words in 4 months.
Oh my goodness.
Interviewing 75 people.
Oh my Lord.
And I could do that because I had my journalism training.
I was just about to say, it gets back to your journalist base, doesn't
where,
it?
Where we had deadlines and we had to turn in work.
Right.
But I don't think most people ever want to be in that situation. I just had to stop doing everything else and only do that.
Well, that's probably a good note for us to end on. But this has been a great interview, Diane. Thank you so much for taking the time.
So much fun. Thank you, Jennifer.
But listen, before we go, where can our listeners find you online and social media?
Well, they can Instagram. Go to dianej.com, dianej.com, and you can see all my social media icons there. On Twitter, I'm at Diane J, D-I-A-N-N-E-J. On Instagram, I'm Diane M. Jacob, J-A-C-O-B. And I can't do Pinterest. It's just too much. okay. I have a Facebook page. I try to be everywhere. I have a free newsletter for people who are interested in food writing.
And people can sign up for that on your website, I think.
Yes, they can.
Yes.
And
that's
an excellent
newsletter.
A blog twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to. I've got a lot of different parts.
Excellent. Well, that's great. So again, listeners, the book is Will Write for Food, Pursue Your Passion and Bring Home the Dough, Writing Recipes, Cookbooks, Blogs, and More, now in its fourth triumphant edition, published by Hachette Books by Diane Jacob. Diane, thank you so much.
It's really fun. Thanks, Jennifer.
Very fun.
Take care.
I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and I'll be back soon to speak with another author about a new book. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks. Take care.